another day. I decided to go. There's probably not enough for everyone, so you'll have to share if anyone really wants to hand it. If you know you might. But I wasn't sure how many people were actually here. So this is, I'm just going to briefly tell you why I have a handout before I get into the paper. This is my attempt to be interdisciplinary as an analytic philosopher. So it's scary. okay, so the paper is called Looking Both Ways. I'm going to talk through the argument and read a part of it, but I don't want it to be about the rhetoric of the argument. I want it to be about the argument. The paper should be called something like Looking Multiple Ways, but Looking Both Ways just sounded more clever, so that was the title that I went with. This paper is based on two sort of sets of problems that I encountered when I started to think about looking at animals in zoos. And one of them is that a lot of the critics of zoos say that people should look at wildlife films. And I found that really strange because, to me, a wildlife film is not actually a way of seeing an animal as much as it's a way of seeing representation of an animal. And yet, there's this discussion in the literature. And the second question, which is on my two questions on handout, was how the question why we look at animals interacts with the question what it means to see an animal. And I think that this becomes problematic in cases where answers to the first question, why look at animals, are formulated after answering the second question, what it means to see an animal. So I find this is really evident in discussions of looking at animals at zoos. People have established already what it means to see that animal caged, not free, however we might describe it at the zoo. And then they answer the question why we look at animals based on that. So this is, of course, why look at animals comes from John Berger, who was discussed earlier. So I've got the response, what it means to see animals at zoos in these discussions, I've called the gaze of the zoo viewer. And the gaze, of course, is understood as an expression of power and control. At the zoo, it objectifies animals and expresses their dominance over them. So this is an answer to question two. So then the answer to question one, why are we looking at these animals, tends to be in terms of people wanting to be entertained, wanting to satisfy their curiosity, wanting to gaze at the exoticness of the animal, the strangeness of their bodies, and things like that. So I find this to be, as someone who works on perception and vision, the environment, I find this to be unsatisfactory, partly because of how it transforms vision. So vision, in the gaze of the zoo viewer, becomes understood as something that is passive. The entertainment aspect is a really underanalyzed concept, and I'm going to come back to that. And it shows that there's only one viewing position, right? The gaze. This is all the gaze. So because the argument about zoos isn't a normative argument, it's a critical argument, I don't think that that step to say that there's only one viewing position is actually warranted by the way that the arguments are constructed. So I think it's relying on a level of the visual that's happening at a cultural level, and that is challenging a particular concept, two particular concepts of vision. So I'm going to go into this part of the paper. Vision, as it's understood in the gaze, reflects a tradition of associating sight and knowledge. The objectivity of vision that neglects subjective meaning and feelings or values. There's also in this a reflection of the long-standing suspicion of the visual. the idea that is all about appearances, that the surface qualities of the world that appear to us in vision are not its significance, not the significance of the world. So a skepticism about objectivity and the power relations that accompany taking one way to be the right way or the true way that things are becomes a skepticism about the vision as the sense that's most associated with that kind of knowledge. This is the anthropocentrism that Karen was talking about earlier. So this is the attitude that comes out in these two, the two sides of this argument about Zeus. One, that vision must be primarily understood as a power relationship. And second, that viewing is cognitively vacuous. It's mere entertainment. Right? The pleasure that we get from viewing is this frivolous, vacuous sort of pleasure. It's about the surfaces of things and not the animals as meaningful in themselves or as significant. So these are two powerful critiques that we have, right? One is the Enlightenment ideals of objectivity and observation. The other one is vision as mere appearance, the appearance versus reality debate that's gone on since Plato. And I think that this neglects the individual differences in vision and what it means to us, and the differences in between visual acts. So a number of philosophers in the 20th century, probably some earlier than that, I've been looking at Hume and Chesterton and some of these guys lately, and they have some discussion of this. Visual acts have been explored under a few different purviews by a number of philosophers, primarily working in aesthetics. Analysis of the differences between visual acts has been in terms of their aptness for certain kinds of works of art or objects, as well as in terms of their success conditions. So normally, to see something is a success term. You see it, it means that you have done something successfully, otherwise you've not seen it. What it means to see an animal can't simply be answered in terms of our having it in our field of vision, having a vivid impression of an animal, although these might be necessary for understanding what it means to see. When we examine these in detail, when we examine visual acts in detail, a different picture emerges that I think works to sort of undermine the idea that there's only one viewing position and that viewing position is the gauge. So I'm moving into talking about vision in action. So in an in-depth analysis of visual concepts, Frank Sibley drew important distinctions between the semantic role of what he called quest and scrutiny verbs and their conditions for success. The logic of quest or seek verbs is that of task and achievement. Seeking, looking for, watching for, or related constructions have success conditions external to the activity itself. The success of seeing X, where X is understood to be whatever it is that is captured under that that condition, where the seeing is the culmination of looking for X, is contingent upon X's being found. The direct object, semantically, of quest verbs is something that's not yet found, and the same thing will be the object of both the task, what you're looking for, and the achievement, what you see. Scrutiny verbs, on the other hand, don't entail the same kind of typical or natural corresponding successes that quest verbs do. Examining, scrutinizing, and watching can all be task verbs, but their success does not rely on external conditions. As tasks, they do not have the same endpoint or culmination. We might examine X to find Y, some other thing about it, but sometimes we examine it without anything particular being sought. We can just scrutinize something that's in our field of vision. To examine X for Y, whatever that is, and find Y, is not the same achievement as looking for and finding the object that you're looking for. The success of scrutiny is internal and independent from the direct object. I can successfully watch for a change in the condition or behavior of an animal, even if no change occurs. I could be looking for something specific, I could be looking for something really specific, general, There's lots of different ways that this can play out. The logic of quest establishes the success conditions for seeing, such that not seeing is its negation. For scrutinies, the conditions for success, completion, or failure can be dependent on standards and conventions defined in part by context and subject matter, what it is you're looking at, why you're looking for it, and all of these questions. Scrutinies are not only ways of looking for, they're ways of looking and will correspondingly provide us with different experiences of the animal that's viewed. This is to say that the acts themselves are different and that we might, that we'll be able to report different things about the animal depending on what the visual act we take towards it is. Not all visual acts have the same objects, the same logic, or the same success condition. The success of quests is generally predicated on our coming to see something. Seeing is the culmination of the act. We look and we see, or we look and we do not see. Scrutinies, however, presuppose our visual access. The success of both quests and scrutinies necessitates that an object be seen. And in this sense, seeing is basic to vision. However, Sibley argues that the concept of seeing in this sense is not an achievement, nor is it a capability. It's rather the exercise of a capability, or what he calls an occurrence. So those are that's the semantic difference between these two different kinds of visual concepts that we employ. There's also, on the other side of that, normative differences that have been developed by Paul Ziff, who's an aesthetician working on in the 60s, 50s and 60s, on philosophy of art, but also early philosophy of the environment, or aesthetics of the environment. Paul Ziff calls these different visual acts of inspection, and I think that that's just a beautiful term for it. There's a quote from him here. He says, this is under Kando, to contemplate a painting is to perform one act of inspection. To scan it is to perform another. To study, observe, survey, inspect, examine, scrutinize, etc., are still other acts of inspection. I survey a Tintoretto while I scan an H. Bosch. Take a step back to look at the Tintoretto, up to look at the Bosch. Different actions are involved. Do you drink brandy in the way that you drink beer? What's important about the normative side of acts of inspection in this sense is that there are different features, different kinds of things that we might be looking at that provide us with guidance for how we are to approach them. And these can be understood in cognitive ways, but they can also be understood purely in perceptual ways. If you're studying cats, you see a lot of cats, you start to notice very fine differences between the cats. You start to look closely at them in different ways. And this can also be embodied. If you're finally discriminating, we move forward to look at some things, we move back to look at others, we move around objects, we recognize that we're not just in a stable position looking out or passively receiving visual information in. This particular formulation of visual acts has been developed by Alan Carlson, who's an environmental aesthetician. And there's a quote from him here too. He says, it seems that we must survey a prairie environment, looking at the subtle contours of the land, feeling the wind blowing across the open space, and smelling the mix of prairie grasses and flowers. But such an act of inspection has little place in a dense forest environment. Here we must examine and scrutinize, inspecting the detail of the forest floor, listening carefully for the sounds of birds, and smelling carefully for the scent of spruce and pine. So these are different environments that demand different approaches. He argues that environments need to be understood in terms of the ecology of them, in terms of what kind of environments they are. This is a very sort of scientific understanding. And that sort of view is in tension. It fits with ideas about art, but it doesn't necessarily fit with ideas about animals. We don't want to say that animals are just one way. We want to be able to approach them as individuals. We don't want to recreate the sort of tensions that exist in environmental philosophy between understanding animals as in terms of species, and we understand them looking at biodiversity and understand them as individuals when we care about them when we're talking about animal rights. And that particular tension is what is reproduced and embodied at the zoo. So I think that looking at the different ways of looking, different positions that we can take as a viewer, both physically and cognitively and perceptually, suggest other possibilities besides dominance for looking at the cultural level of our shared understanding of our interactions with animals. And it also suggests ways to talk about differences between zoos and film. So film is representation, not a presentation. Films present a narrativized animal where the selections have been done by the editors, by the filmmaker. They're presenting certain sides of the animal, certain perspectives. And this and that animal, as it's represented, narrated, is watched on the screen without the capability of engaging in multiple visual acts with an animal in one sort of session of viewing it. The zoo, on the other hand, has a possibility for allowing us to have non-representational visual engagement with the animal. And it could be that this could suggest ways that zoos might change their design practices to not only to minimize the adopting the gaze as a viewing position towards animals, but also to teach us ways to engage more passionately, more individually, more emotionally with animals when we see them there. And I'll end it there, so I'm on time.